Part 3. From the calling of Abraham to Moses. I proceed now to show how the work of redemption was carried on from the calling of Abraham to Moses. And 1. It pleased God now to separate that person of whom Christ was to come, from the rest of the world, that his church might be upheld in his family and posterity till that time. He called Abraham out of his own country, and from his kindred, to go into a distant country, that God should show him. And brought him first out of Ur of the Chaldees to Sharon, and then to the land of Canaan. It was before observed that the idolatrous corruption of the world was now become general. Mankind were almost wholly overrun with idolatry. God therefore saw it necessary, in order to uphold true religion in the world, that there should be a family separated from all others. It proved to be high time to take this course, lest the Church of Christ should wholly be carried away with the apostasy. For Abraham's own country and kindred had most of them fallen off. And without some extraordinary interposition of providence, in all likelihood, in a generation or two more, the true religion in this line would have been extinct. And therefore God called Abraham, the person in whose family he intended to uphold the true religion, out of his own country, and from his kindred, to a far distant country, that his posterity might there remain a people separate from all the rest of the world. That so the true religion might be upheld there, while all mankind besides were swallowed up in heathenism. The land of the Chaldees, whence Abraham was called, was the country about Babel. Babel, or Babylon, was the chief city of Chaldea. Learned men suppose by what they gather from the most ancient accounts of things, that it was in this land idolatry first began. That Babel and Chaldea were the original and chief seats of the worship of idols, whence it spread into other nations. And therefore the land of the Chaldeans, the country of Babylon, is in Scripture called the land of graven images. Jeremiah 50:35-38. A sword is upon the Chaldeans, saith the Lord, and upon the inhabitants of Babylon, and upon her princes, and upon her wise men. A drought is upon her waters, and they shall be dried up. For it is the land of graven images, and they are mad upon their idols. God calls Abraham out of this idolatrous country, to a great distance from it. And when he came there, he gave him no inheritance in it, no, not so much as to set his foot on. But he remained a stranger and a sojourner, that he and his family might be kept separate from all the world. This was a new thing. God had never taken such a method before. His church had not in this manner been separated from the rest of the world till now. But were wont to dwell with them, without any bar or fence to keep them separate. The mischievous consequence of which had been found once and again. Before the flood, the effect of God's people living intermingled with the wicked world, without any remarkable wall of separation, was that the sons of the church joined in marriage with others, and thereby almost all soon became infected, and the church was almost brought to nothing. The method that God then took to fence the church was to drown the wicked world and save the church in the ark. Before Abraham was called, the world was become corrupt again. But now God took another method. He did not destroy the wicked world and save Abraham and his wife and Lot, but calls these persons to go and live separate from the rest of the world. This was a new and great thing that God did toward the work of redemption. It was about the middle of the space of time between the fall of man and the coming of Christ. About 2,000 years before the great Redeemer was to appear. But by this calling of Abraham, the ancestor of Christ, a foundation was laid for upholding the church in the world, till Christ should come. For the world having become idolatrous, there was a necessity in order to this, that the seed of the woman should be thus separated from it. And then it was needful that there should be a particular nation separated from the rest of the world, to receive the types and prophecies that were to be given of Christ, to prepare the way for his coming. That to them might be committed the oracles of God. That by them the history of God's great works of creation and providence might be preserved. That Christ might be born of this nation. And that from hence the light of the gospel might shine forth to the rest of the world. These ends could not well be obtained, if God's people, through all these 2,000 years, had lived intermixed with the heathen world. so that the calling of Abraham may be looked upon as a kind of new foundation laid for the visible church of God, in a more distinct and regular state. Abraham, being the person in whom this foundation is laid, is represented in Scripture as though he were the father of all the church, the father of all them that believe. A root whence the visible church rose as a tree, distinct from all other plants. Of this tree Christ was the branch of righteousness. And from it, after Christ came, the natural branches were broken off, and the Gentiles were grafted in. So that Abraham still remains the father, the root of the church. It is the same tree which, from that small beginning in Abraham's time, has in these days of the gospel spread its branches over a great part of the earth, and will fill the whole in due time, and at the end of the world shall be transplanted from an earthly soil into the paradise of God. 2. There accompanied this a more particular and full revelation and confirmation of the covenant of grace than ever before. There had been before this two particular and solemn additions or confirmations of this covenant. 1. To our first parents, soon after the fall. The other, to Noah and his family, soon after the flood. And now there is a third, at and after the calling of Abraham. It is now revealed to Abraham, not only that Christ should come, but that he should be his seed, and promised that all the families of the earth should be blessed in him. And God repeated the promises of this to Abraham. The first promise was when he first called him, Genesis 12:2. And I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee, and make thy name great. And thou shalt be a blessing. The same promise was renewed after he came into the land of Canaan, Genesis 13:14-17. Again after Abraham had returned from the slaughter of the kings, Genesis 15:5-6. And a fourth time, after his offering up Isaac, Genesis 22:16-18. In this renewal of the covenant of grace with Abraham, several particulars concerning it were revealed more fully than before. Not only that Christ was to be of Abraham's seed, but also, the calling of the Gentiles, that all nations should be brought into the church, all the families of the earth made blessed. And then the great condition of the covenant of grace, which is faith, was now more fully made known. Genesis 15:5-6. And he said unto him, So shall thy seed be. And Abraham believed God, and it was counted unto him for righteousness. Which is much noticed in the New Testament, as that for which Abraham was called the father of believers. And as there was now a further revelation of the covenant of grace, so there was a further confirmation of it by seals and pledges. Particularly, circumcision, which was a seal of the covenant of grace, as appears by the first institution of it, Genesis 17. It there appears to be a seal of that covenant by which God promised to make Abraham a father of many nations, Genesis 17:5-9-10. And we are expressly taught that it was a seal of righteousness of faith, Romans 4:11. Speaking of Abraham, the apostle says, He received the sign of circumcision, a seal of the righteousness of faith. Abraham's family and posterity must be kept separate from the rest of the world, till Christ should come. And this sacrament was the principal wall of separation. Besides, God gave Abraham a remarkable pledge of the fulfillment of the promise he had made him, in his victory over Chedorlaomer and the kings that were with him. Chedorlaomer seems to have been a great emperor, who reigned over a great part of the world at that day. And though he had his seat at Elam, which was not much, if anything, short of 1,000 miles distant from the land of Canaan, yet he extended his empire so as to reign over many parts of the land of Canaan, as appears by Genesis 14:4-7. It is supposed by learned men that he was a king of the Assyrian Empire at that day, which had been before begun by Nimrod at Babel. And as it was the honor of kings in those days to build cities for the seat of their empire, Genesis 10:10-12. So it is conjectured that he had gone forth and built him a city in Elam, and made that his seat. And that those other kings who came with him were his deputies in the several cities and countries where they reigned. But yet as mighty an empire as he had, and as great an army as he came with, Abraham, only with his trained servants, that were born in his house, conquered and subdued this mighty emperor, the kings that came with him, and all their army. This he received of God as a pledge of what he had promised, namely, The victory that Christ's seed should obtain over the nations of the earth, whereby he should possess the gates of his enemies. It is plainly spoken of as such in the 41st of Isaiah. In that chapter is foretold the future glorious victory the church shall obtain over the nations of the world, Isaiah 41:1, 10, 15. This victory of Abraham over such a great emperor and his mighty forces is spoken of as a pledge in earnest of victory to the church, Isaiah 41:2, 3. Who raised up the righteous man from the east, called him to his foot, gave the nations before him, and made him rule over kings. He gave them as the dust to his sword, and as driven stubble to his bow. He pursued them, and passed safely, even by the way that he had not gone with his feet. Another remarkable confirmation Abraham received of the covenant of grace was when he returned from the slaughter of the kings. When Melchizedek, the king of Salem, the priest of the Most High God, that great type of Christ, met him, and blessed him, and brought forth bread and wine. The bread and wine signify the same blessings of the covenant of grace that the bread and wine does in the sacrament of the Lord's Supper. As Abraham had a seal of the covenant in circumcision that was equivalent to baptism, so now he had a seal of it equivalent to the Lord's Supper. And Melchizedek's coming to meet him with such a seal of the covenant of grace, on the occasion of this victory, evinces that it was a pledge of God's fulfillment of the same covenant. Genesis 14:19, 20. Another confirmation of the covenant of grace was the vision he had, in the deep sleep that fell upon him, of the smoking furnace and burning lamp that passed between the parts of the sacrifice. Genesis 15. The sacrifice signified that of Christ. The smoking furnace that passed through the midst of the sacrifice first signified the sufferings of Christ. But the burning lamp that followed, which shone with a clear bright light, signifies the glory that followed Christ's sufferings and was procured by them. Another remarkable pledge that God gave Abraham of the fulfillment of the covenant of grace was his giving of that child of whom Christ was to come in his old age, Hebrews 11:11, 12 and Romans 4:18-25, and his delivering Isaac after he was laid upon the wood of the sacrifice to be slain. This was a confirmation of Abraham's faith in the promise that God had made of Christ that he should be of Isaac's posterity, and was a representation of the resurrection of Christ. Hebrews 11:17-19. And because this was given as a confirmation of the covenant of grace, therefore God renewed the covenant with Abraham on this occasion, Genesis 22:15-18. Thus you see how much more fully the covenant of grace was revealed and confirmed in Abraham's time than ever it had been before, by means of which Abraham seems to have had a clear view of Christ the great Redeemer, and the future things that were to be accomplished by him. And therefore Christ informs us that Abraham rejoiced to see his day, and he saw it and was glad, John 8:56. So great in advance did it please God now to make in this building, which he had been carrying on from the beginning of the world. 3. The next thing is God's preserving the patriarchs for so long a time in the midst of the wicked inhabitants of Canaan, and from all other enemies. The patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, were those of whom Christ was to proceed. And they were now separated from the world, that in them his church might be upheld. Therefore, in preserving them, the great design of redemption was carried on. He preserved them, and kept the inhabitants of the land where they sojourned from destroying them, which was a remarkable dispensation of providence. For the inhabitants of the land were at that day very wicked, though they grew more wicked afterwards. This appears by Genesis 15:16. In the fourth generation they shall come hither again. For the iniquity of the Canaanites is not yet full, as much as to say, though it be very great, yet it is not yet full. And their great wickedness also appears by Abraham and Isaac's aversion to their children marrying any of the daughters of the land. Abraham, when he was old, could not be content till he had made his servant swear that he would not take a wife for a son of the daughters of the land. And Isaac and Rebekah were content to send away Jacob to so great a distance as Padan Aram, to take him a wife thence. And when Esau married some of the daughters of the land, we are told that they were a grief of mind to Isaac and Rebekah. Another argument of their great wickedness was the instances we have in Sodom and Gomorrah, Admah and Zeboim, which were some of the cities of Canaan, though they were probably most notoriously wicked and likely to have the most bitter enmity against these holy men. Agreeable to what was declared at first, I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed. 617 Their holy lives were a continual condemnation of their wickedness. Besides, it could not be otherwise, but that they must be much in reproving their wickedness, as we find Lot was in Sodom, who, we are told, vexed his righteous soul with their unlawful deeds, and was to them a preacher of righteousness. And they were the more exposed to them, being strangers and sojourners in the land, and having as yet no inheritance there. Men are more apt to find fault with strangers, and to be irritated by anything in them that offends, as they were with Lot and Sodom. He very gently reproved their wickedness. And they say upon it, "This fellow came in to sojourn, and he will needs be a ruler and a judge," and threatened what they would do to him. But God wonderfully preserved Abraham and Lot, Isaac and Jacob, and their families, amongst them, though they were few in number, and they might quickly have destroyed them. Which is taken notice of as a wonderful instance of God's preserving mercy towards His church, Psalm 105:12-15. When they were but a few men in number, yea, very few, and strangers in it. When they went from one nation to another, from one kingdom to another people, He suffered no man to do them wrong. Yea, He reproved kings for their sakes, saying, "Touch not mine anointed, and do my prophets no harm." This preservation was, in some instances especially, very remarkable. When the people of the land were greatly irritated and provoked, as they were by Simeon and Levi's treatment of the Shechemites, in Genesis 34:30-31, God then strangely preserved Jacob and his family, restraining the provoked people by an unusual terror on their minds. Genesis 35:5. And the terror of God was upon the cities that were round about them, and they did not pursue after the sons of Jacob. And God preserved them, not only from the Canaanites, but from all others that intended mischief to them. He preserved Jacob and his company, when pursued by Laban, full of rage, and a disposition to overtake him as an enemy. God met him, rebuked him, and said to him, "Take heed that thou speak not to Jacob either good or bad." How wonderfully did He also preserve him from Esau his brother, when he came forth with an army, with a full design to cut him off. How did God, in answer to his prayer, when Jacob wrestled with Christ at Peniel, wonderfully turn Esau's heart, and make him, instead of meeting him as an enemy with slaughter and destruction, to meet him as a friend and brother, doing him no harm. And thus was this handful, this little root that had the blessing of the Redeemer in it, preserved in the midst of enemies and dangers, which was not unlike to preserving the ark in the midst of the tempestuous deluge. For the next thing I would mention is, the awful destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, and the neighboring cities. This tended to promote the great work designed two ways. First, as it tended powerfully to restrain the inhabitants of the land from injuring those holy strangers that God had brought to sojourn amongst them. Lot was one of those strangers. He came into the land with Abraham. And Sodom was destroyed for their abusive disregard of Lot, the preacher of righteousness. And their destruction came upon their committing a most injurious and abominable insult on Lot, and the strangers that were come into his house, even those angels, whom they probably took to be some of Lot's former acquaintance come to visit him. They in a most outrageous manner beset Lot's house, intending a monstrous abuse and act of violence on those strangers, and threatening to serve Lot worse than them. But in the midst of this God smote them with blindness. And the next morning the city and the country about it was overthrown in a most terrible storm of fire and brimstone. Which dreadful destruction, as it was in the sight of the rest of the inhabitants of the land, and therefore greatly tended to restrain them from hurting those holy strangers any more. It doubtless struck a dread and terror on their minds, and made them afraid to hurt them, and probably was one principal means to restrain them, and preserve the patriarchs. And when that reason is given, why the inhabitants of the land did not pursue after Jacob, when they were so provoked by the destruction of the Shechemites, namely, that the terror of the Lord was upon them. It is very probable that this was the terror which was set home upon them. They remembered the amazing destruction of Sodom, and the cities of the plain, that came upon them for their abusive treatment of Lot, and so durst not hurt Jacob and his family, though they were so much provoked to it. Another way that this awful destruction tended to promote this great affair of redemption was that hereby God remarkably exhibited the terrors of his law to make men sensible of their need of redeeming mercy. The work of redemption never was carried on without this. The law, from the beginning, is made use of as a schoolmaster to bring men to Christ. But under the Old Testament there was much more need of some extraordinary, visible, and sensible manifestation of God's wrath against sin than in the days of the gospel. Since a future state and the eternal misery of hell is more clearly revealed, and since the awful justice of God against the sins of men has been so wonderfully displayed in the sufferings of Christ, and therefore the revelation that God gave of himself in those days used to be accompanied with much more terror than it is in these days of the gospel. So when God appeared at Mount Sinai to give the law, it was with thunders and lightnings, and a thick cloud, and the voice of the trumpet exceeding loud. Some external, awful manifestations of God's wrath against sin were on some accounts especially necessary before the giving of the law, and therefore, before the flood, the terrors of the law handed down by tradition from Adam served for that purpose. Adam lived 930 years himself to proclaim God's awful threatenings denounced in the covenant made with him, and how dreadful the consequences of the fall were. And others, that conversed with Adam, lived till the flood. And the destruction of the world by the flood served to exhibit the terrors of the law, and manifested the wrath of God against sin. In order to make men sensible of the absolute necessity of redeeming mercy. And some that saw the flood were alive in Abraham's time. But this was now in a great measure forgotten. Therefore God was pleased again, in a most amazing manner, to show his wrath against sin, in the destruction of these cities, which was the liveliest image of hell of anything that ever had been. And therefore the Apostle Jude says, they suffer the vengeance of eternal fire, Jude 7. God rained storms of fire and brimstone upon them, probably by thick flashes of lightning. The streams of brimstone burnt up all these cities, so that they perished in the flames of divine wrath. By this might be seen the dreadful wrath of God against the ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, which tended to show the necessity of redemption, and so to promote that great work. 5. God again renewed and confirmed the covenant of grace to Isaac and Jacob. To Isaac in these words, Genesis 26:3-4, and I will perform the oath which I swear unto Abraham thy father. And I will make thy seed to multiply as the stars of heaven, and will give unto thy seed all these countries. And in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. And afterwards to Jacob. First, in Isaac blessing him and his seed, wherein he acted and spoke by extraordinary divine direction, Genesis 27:29. Let people serve thee, and nations bow down to thee. Be Lord over thy brethren, and let thy mother's sons bow down to thee. Cursed be every one that curseth thee, and blessed be he that blesseth thee. And therefore Esau, not included in this blessing, missed of being blessed as an heir of the benefits of the covenant of grace. This covenant was again renewed and confirmed to Jacob at Bethel, in his vision of the ladder that reached to heaven, which was a symbol of the way of salvation by Christ. The stone that Jacob rested on was a type of Christ, the stone of Israel, which the spiritual Israel rests upon, as is evident, because it was anointed, and made use of as an altar. But we know that Christ is the anointed of God, and is the only true altar. While Jacob was resting on this stone, and saw this ladder, God appears to him as his covenant God, and renews the covenant of grace with him. As in Genesis 28:14, and thy seed shall be as the dust of the earth, and thou shalt spread abroad to the west, and to the east, and to the north, and to the south, and in thee and in thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Jacob had another remarkable confirmation of this covenant at Peniel, where he wrestled with God, and prevailed, where Christ appeared to him in the form of that nature which he was afterwards to receive in a personal union with his divine nature. And God renewed his covenant with him again, after he left Padan Aram, and was come up to Bethel, and where he had the vision of the ladder. As you may see in Genesis 35:10-15. Thus the covenant of grace was now renewed much oftener than it had been before. The light of the gospel now began to shine much brighter, as the time of Christ's appearing drew nearer. 6. The next thing I would observe is God's remarkably preserving the family of which Christ was to proceed from perishing by famine, by the instrumentality of Joseph. When there was a 7 years famine approaching, God was pleased, by a wonderful providence, to send Joseph into Egypt, there to provide for Jacob and his family, and to keep the holy seed alive, which otherwise would have perished. Joseph was sent into Egypt for that end, as he observes, Genesis 50:20. But as for you, ye thought evil against me. But God meant it unto good, to save much people alive. How often had this holy root, that had in it the future branch of righteousness, the glorious Redeemer, been in danger of being destroyed? But God wonderfully preserved it. This salvation of the house of Israel, by the hand of Joseph, was upon some accounts very much a resemblance of the salvation of Christ. The children of Israel were saved by Joseph their kinsman and brother, from perishing by famine. As he that saves the souls of the spiritual Israel from spiritual famine is their near kinsman, and one that is not ashamed to call them brethren, Joseph was a brother they had hated, sold, and as it were killed. For they had designed to kill him. So Christ is one that we naturally hate, and by our wicked lives, have sold for the vain things of the world, and by our sins have slain. Joseph was first in a state of humiliation. He was a servant, as Christ appeared in the form of a servant. And then was cast into a dungeon, as Christ descended into the grave. When he rose out of the dungeon, he was in a state of great exultation, at the king's right hand as his deputy, to reign over all his kingdom, to provide food, to preserve life. And being in this state of exultation, he dispenses food to his brethren, and so gives them life. So Christ was exalted at God's right hand to be a prince and savior to his brethren, received gifts for men, even for the rebellious, them that had hated and sold him. 7. After this there was a prophecy of Christ, on some accounts more particular than any before, in Jacob's blessing his son Judah. This was more particular as it showed of whose posterity he was to be. When God called Abraham, it was revealed that he was to be of Abraham's posterity. Before, we have no account of any revelation concerning Christ's pedigree confined to narrower limits than the posterity of Noah. After this it was confined to still narrower limits. For though Abraham had many sons, yet it was revealed that Christ was to be of Isaac's posterity. And then it was limited still more. For when Isaac had two sons, it was revealed that Christ was to be of Israel's posterity. And now, though Israel had 12 sons, yet it is revealed that Christ should be of Judah's posterity. Christ is the lion of the tribe of Judah. Respect is chiefly had to his great acts, when it is said here. Genesis 49:8. Judah, thou art he whom thy brethren shall praise. Thy hand shall be in the neck of thine enemies. Thy father's children shall bow down before thee. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, thou art gone up. He stooped down, he couched as a lion, and as an old lion. Who shall rouse him up? And then this prediction is more particular concerning the time of Christ's coming, as in Genesis 49:10. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh come. And unto him shall the gathering of the people be. The prophecy here, of the calling of the Gentiles consequent on Christ's coming, seems to be more plain than any had been before, in the expression, to him shall the gathering of the people be. 618 Thus you see how that gospel light which dawned immediately after the fall of man, gradually increases. 8 The work of redemption was carried on in this period, in God's wonderfully preserving the children of Israel in Egypt, when the power of Egypt was engaged utterly to destroy them. They seemed to be wholly in the hands of the Egyptians. They were their servants, and were subject to the power of Pharaoh, and Pharaoh set himself to weaken them with hard bondage. And when he saw that did not do, he set himself to extirpate their race, by commanding that every male child should be drowned. But after all that Pharaoh could do, God wonderfully preserved them. And not only so, but increased them exceedingly. So that, instead of being extirpated, they greatly multiplied. 9 Here is to be observed, not only the preservation of the nation, but God's wonderfully preserving and upholding His invisible church in that nation, when in danger of being overwhelmed in the idolatry of Egypt. The children of Israel being long among the Egyptians, and servants under them, and so not having advantages to keep God's ordinances among themselves, and maintain any public worship or instruction, whereby the true religion might be upheld, and there being now no written word, they by degrees, in a great measure, lost the true religion, and borrowed the idolatry of Egypt. And the greater part of the people fell away to the worship of their gods. This we learn by Ezekiel 26, 7, 8, 23, 8. This now was the third time that God's church was almost swallowed up and carried away with the wickedness of the world. Once before the flood. The other time, before the calling of Abraham. And now, the third time, in Egypt. But yet God did not suffer His church to be quite overwhelmed. He still saved it, like the ark in the flood, and as He saved Moses in the midst of the waters, in an ark of bulrushes, where he was in the utmost danger of being swallowed up. The true religion was still kept up with some. And God had still a people among them, even in this miserable, corrupt, and dark time. The parents of Moses were true servants of God, as we may deem by Hebrews 11:23. By faith Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months of his parents, because they saw that he was a proper child. And they were not afraid of the king's commandment. I have now shown how the work of redemption was carried on from the calling of Abraham to Moses, in which we have seen many great things done towards this work, and a great advancement of this building, beyond what had preceded.